This episode is sponsored by Macmillan Audio. This week, I'm excited to share a sneak peek of The Divorcees by Rowan Baird, read by Bailey Carr.
June and Vera have belts with filigreed silver buckles. Dorothy wears bangles dotted with turquoise. The clothing makes the girls sit differently, resting their elbows on the table and slumping ever so slightly into their chair backs, a foot dangling at their knees. It's not that they act like men, but like girls when no men are present. Lois feels foolish in her dress, as if she'd shown up to an intimate dinner party wearing white satin gloves. She doesn't even own a pair of jeans.
Start listening to The Divorcees by Rowan Baird now, wherever audiobooks are sold. Welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm your host, librarian and writer, Laura Zaro-Kopinski. And today I'm so excited that Amy Techter is back on the podcast to discuss Honor the Dead, the third book in her captivating Dominion Archives mystery series, which is perfect for Louise Penny fans. I have been enjoying this series so much. Murder mysteries with really well-developed characters, vivid settings, also not too dark. That's kind of my wheelhouse, so I highly recommend it to anyone seeking the same sort of read. Amy was born and raised in the rolling hills of Quebec's eastern townships. She's worked in archives for the past 20 years and has found some pretty amazing things, including lost letters, mysterious notes, and even a whale's ear. Amy spent many years as an expat living in Brussels and in The Hague, where she worked for the International Criminal Tribunal for War Crimes in Yugoslavia. She lives in Ottawa, Canada, with her daughter, dog, and husband. Amy, congratulations on Honor the Dead, and thanks for coming back on. It's always so much fun chatting with you.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Can you tell listeners who haven't gotten to dive into this series yet a bit about the Dominion Archives series as a whole? And then I'd love for you to share more about this third installment in particular.
Sure. Yeah. Well, as you said, I've worked for Canada's National Archives for more than 20 years, which is grim, is a mystery. But anyway, and in that time, I have been struck over and over again about not only the stories that you can find in the archives, but just kind of how magical and interesting working in an archives itself is and sort of the processes and things like that. I'm kind of an archives nerd. So it was really natural for me when I started to think about writing a mystery to set that mystery in an archives. And that's really the sort of overarching theme of all three books. Three, yes. I can't believe that. Is this sort of that tie to history. And what I have seen in my work, and I've done a bunch of different things over the years, is not just how interesting history is as a story to sort of learn, but how what has happened in the past impacts us today and has reverberations. And we see that, of course, every time we look at the news, you know, any news item, there are historical lessons there that have been learned or haven't been learned that are affecting everybody's actions today. And I find that really fascinating. And so for me, what I really enjoy doing is taking something that happened in the past and then linking it to something urgent, usually, well, a murder in my case, murder mysteries that's happening in the present, and then have my protagonists have to sort of untangle that and sort of suss out those connections. And I find that really interesting. And I certainly enjoy that in the books that I read as well, the kind of fiction that I gravitate to as a reader. So that's the overarching kind of theme, I think, is the impact of the effect of history on the present day and how to untangle that. And I really like to use archives as a setting because I think people are interested in it. My little sister read my first book when it was in draft form, and she said, "Oh, there's a lot about archives, but it's not too boring." Thanks, I guess. So that's where my mind is at with that.
And then for Honor the Dead in particular, can you kind of tell us what is happening, sort of the premise, once we get to this third book?
Sure. Yeah. So, there are three books now. And the first one, The Foulest Things, is a bit of a standalone. It's almost a prequel to the next two. So Speak for the Dead was the previous one. Now I'm going back into history to explain Speak for the Dead introduced us to Dr. Kate Spencer, who is a coroner and a medical doctor. And she gets embroiled in a mystery at an archival premise where she discovers a body and has to solve that murder. And so in this in Ottawa, and the setting is in a building that belongs to the National Archives. So that's sort of where the Archives comes in, or the Dominion Archives, I should say. And so Honor the Dead opens with Kate again. So we're following her story now. And she's had a kind of a tumultuous few months, and she's sort of nursing her wounds. She's left the city of Ottawa. She's through some circumstances has ended up in the Eastern Townships, which, as you said, is where I'm from. And mystery readers might be familiar with it because it is Louise Penny territory as well. But I've created a different world to Three Pines because I don't want to step on Louise Penny's toes. So Kate ends up in this, she's in a sort of a rural location, and she's not working as a coroner, which is her true love. Instead, she, for various reasons, she's working as a general practitioner on a temporary basis while she hopes to get back to doing her coroner work in Ottawa. And so she's working there. She's a bit lonely. She's kind of nursing her wounds from the previous book. And of course, what happens, she discovers there's sort of police action at the neighboring farm. And so she goes over to check it out, thinking she might be able to help as a doctor. But instead she discovers a murder victim lying in the apple orchard with a bullet perfectly shot with deadly accuracy through his eye and a metal detector lying by his side. And so Kate decides she needs to help out the local police and try to figure things out. And so that, engulfs her in all the local politics, local history, local secrets, as she untangles what has happened to this man and how he has arrived where he has.
It always feels strange to say that a murder mystery is a fun read, but it was a fun read. Okay. And just very enjoyable. And I really, I was guessing the whole time, and I really liked the setting of this one and all the different characters that we meet. And I wondered, did it take you a while to land on this premise or to kind of figure out what you wanted to have happen to Kate next? Or did this come pretty quickly to you?
Well, it did take me a while because the series, as my publisher is positioning it, is called the Dominion Archives Mysteries. And the Dominion Archives is this fictional national archives where the books have all taken place. And so when I suddenly was writing about the Eastern Townships, which is, you know, very dear to my heart because it's where I grew up, and I really, it's a unique kind of environment. It's very beautiful. It's kind of like Vermont, but in Quebec. So there's a French English thing too going on, which I find quite interesting. Anyway, so I really wanted to explore that. And so I thought, well, I'll have a couple of scenes in the townships. And then of course I have to get Kate back to Ottawa because this is a Dominion Archives mystery. So it has to take place around the Dominion Archives. And I kept trying to bring her back to Ottawa and none of those scenes worked. And she kept ending up back in the Eastern Townships. And so then finally I was like, I can't do it this way. It's going to be a Dominion Archives mystery that actually doesn't have very much to do with the Dominion Archives. I did squeeze in archives anyway, but so that was hard. But I was impelled by as soon as I started writing about the townships, I was like, oh, this is really nice. And I liked thinking through all the sort of trying to capture the scenery and kind of the vibe of the people and the different characters that you meet and the sort of cadence of speech and the perspective that people have who live, you know, right on the border with the United States, but, and also right in this border between French and English, relationships and the different histories of the settlement and of the area, like all of that. I was so into it that I couldn't bring myself to come back to Ottawa. So
did you get any, it sounds like you were kind of afraid you might get pushback from your publisher. Did that happen at all?
No, they were really they've been really supportive of everything that I've done. So no, they read the draft obviously. And they were like, you're good. So that was really helpful.
Well, it's a similar spirit to the other books, you know, even though it's not actually in the Dominion Archives. It's got a very similar feel. And then you do bring the archives in again. So
it
all fits. Well, you know, I'm curious, as you know, this is your third book in this series now, and so you've had kind of three different times crafting a murder mystery. Is there anything about your process you want to share? Kind of what is your writing process like? Has it changed at all book to book? Give us maybe a window into that.
Yeah, sure. I have a bad process. I have a very inefficient process. So I cannot in any way plan the writing. So if anyone is listening who, you know, writes by the seat of their pants, I'm your girl. I understand that. And I envy writers who can, you know, make the whiteboard or have the post-it notes and sort of work out what's going to happen beforehand. My process is that I start with just a kernel of an idea. So for this one, it was, you know, somebody's dead in an apple orchard. Okay, how did they get there? What happened? What does that look like? I knew I would have Kate recurring, so that kind of made things easier. So then, how's Kate going to react? What's going to be her arc? And that's how it has been for all of my books. I just start with one little idea, and then I just start writing. And I honestly think that I type. I don't do longhand. I really actually think that it's when my hands are on the keyboard that my brain starts working. So until that moment where I start putting words onto the screen, that's when I start thinking about the story. And I have a lot of trouble conceptualizing the book if I'm not writing about the book. So it makes it that I can't sort of go off for a long walk and work out the plot elements in my head, because nothing's kind of happening. I'm on my walk and I'm looking at the trees and I'm thinking about the pothole in front of me. Like, so I really have to be typing in order to write, which makes it very inefficient. And what then happens is I'll write whole scenes, I'll write whole chapters, I'll write whole characters, and I'll go along, and then I'll realize, no, I've gone the wrong way. This isn't going to work. And then I have to mercilessly cut them. And I think what has happened in my writing process, as I've done this now more, you know, for a few books, is I've become more confident in that process. I used to get really freaked out, and I used to fight with myself and be like, no, I have to do it this way. Like, I had a whole different ending to this, to Honor the Dead, that completely got scrapped, and you know, I was toying with a completely different murderer for the ending.
Oh,
and then
wow.
Go back and then you have to redo everything so that it makes sense and leads you to the right place. But I now understand that that, as inefficient and irritating to myself that process is, that is my process. And so I don't fight it as much. So I have become slightly more efficient in how I write, because I now think, okay, no, I've gone down the wrong path, and I really love this scene and I really love this character, but they're getting the chop, and I'm going back to trying, and I'm better with that. So there's a bit more angst, and a bit less angst and more confidence now when I write, which I think is better for my mental health.
It's helpful to hear that, though. I feel very similar when you're saying you can't figure out what happens unless you're typing. I think I'm very similar, and that has led to a very long writing process in what I'm working on, and lots of things scrapped. And I'm finding I can only sort of plan when I'm going back and revising. Like, there I can kind of change things at more of like a, with more of like a planner mindset. But I feel like definitely in the first draft, anything I tried to plan, I just like never wrote my way to. I don't know.
And that is like, it's exactly, I hate doing the first draft. I'm just like, this is garbage. It's terrible. It's stupid and I don't like it. But then the revision is where I start to get excited. I think because then it sounds like you're the same way. You've then sort of created a de facto outline. The outline is in fact the entire book, but now at least you know, okay, I want to get to point C. So now maybe I need to fix point B so that it makes more sense, or, you know, is more compelling. But it then you've got the structure to play with. But you need to getting that first draft out. I have to just I can't plan it.
Yeah, you know, it's almost, my wheels are just kind of spinning now. It's almost like I don't feel very in control of the first draft and like can't really make the characters do what I want them to do. But then when I go back and revise, I feel like I'm able to sort of be a little more in charge, if that makes sense.
No, like, I love that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. But that's interesting to hear. But I think I'm still in the phase of like railing against that a little bit. So yeah. I probably just need to go with it and then, you know, be okay in the revision process.
Well, super cliche, but it is that like, trust your process, and you've got to figure, nobody's process is the same. So you've got to figure out what your process is, which is very painful. And then just have faith in yourself that you do know what you're doing. And then it does make things, I think, easier and more efficient once you accept how you work.
Well, and as you're saying that sort of the first draft almost becomes your outline, I know right now I'm kind of looking at different structure books and like Save the Cat and different things and kind of going back now and like finessing things a little bit to like make more of a structure, but I definitely don't have that when I start. Are you in a similar place at all where you kind of like see if what you have is like mapping on to any sort of structure?
Yeah. And I, because of the way that I work, I find any kind of craft book that is dictating how the thing should be daunting, but in the revision process is where you can then, or for me, I can start to think about that. And I need to, cause I, you know, I have the dreaded mushy middle in my life and in my writing, mushy middle, but, And so that's the place, right, where your structure really, where thinking through those beats and making sure that every scene is you know, impelling the character, the action or the setting or the theme forward in some way, like all those things to think about. It is really useful in one of the revision rounds. And I do a ton of revision to just go back and think through, like be more logical and sort of systematic in the approach to the writing. But I need to have a lot on the page before I'm able to do that. I can't do that beforehand.
That makes a lot of sense. And I know you have said that a critique group is very important to your process. So I'd love to hear about that. And I'm also curious if you wait to bring that critique group in until you have that kind of messy first draft, or if they're more seeing chapters kind of as you're drafting them. What is that process like?
I would say that my critique group is the reason that I am writing, and it's the reason that I'm published. I was lucky enough to kind of find them in real life, like it's almost 25 years ago now, through continuing education sort of writing group. And I met a couple of people there and we hit it off and we were like, oh, well, we don't have to pay to do this. We could just meet on our own. And so we've been together now for 25 years.
Wow.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. And so, you know, we've evolved over these years. Now we do everything via, was Skype. Like even pre-pandemic, we were meeting online because people had moved. One person now lives in Scotland. Somebody else lives in Northern Canada. So we have been meeting online for many, many years. And what we tend to do is sort of chunks. So 3 or 4 chapters at a time of the thing as it's developing. So for me, they are my alpha readers, I guess. They are reading very, maybe not the very first draft, because that is really not fit for anybody's eyes. But when I feel like, okay, I'm in pretty good shape. So I'll have at least half written probably. And then I'll start sharing sort of chapters 1 to 5 and get their feedback. And then if they're like, this character isn't making any sense, Amy, or I'm completely lost in your plot. You need to straighten out who's doing what and why. I'll go back and I'll revise those 5 chapters that they've seen. And I won't give those first 5 back to them, but I will then revise the next 5 to reflect their critique. So I'm sort of improving as I go, and then I'll send them the next 5 and they'll give me that feedback. And then I'll go back and I'll sort of revise behind me and revise ahead of me and give them give them the chapters. And I don't, I mean, we've known each other for long enough, and I'm sort of confident, I guess, now enough in what I'm doing that I don't take everything they say and apply it. And I know, you know, some people have, you know, one person's a real grammar stickler, and so they're, but some, and, you know, somebody else is always looking for the emotionality in the scene and so wants more of that. Somebody else really is paying attention to setting. So, you know, I know them well enough now to understand where they're coming from, and then and take what I find valuable and useful and apply that to my writing, as opposed to think that I have to apply all their critique to what I'm doing. But it's really valuable. And why I say I don't think I would be published is because, you know, I've been writing for 20 plus years, but only was published in the past sort of three, maybe it's not even 5 years ago. So very recently published. So I've had a long time, I've had a long period of writing things and having them be rejected. And that's really hard, right? Like you, it's demoralizing. And if you're doing this at nights and, you know, you're stealing time away from your family and your kids and your job or your whatever, because you want to write, and you're just, you're not getting any external encouragement, it's pretty hard to keep going. And the reason that I kept going is because I stopped at one point or other, I stopped thinking that publishing was the end game. And I started writing really for my critique group, because I knew those people were interested in what I was doing. They're my cheerleaders, and they would encourage me. So I would be like, oh, I have to write three chapters because I told them I would. And I found it so creatively fulfilling, even if, you know, the project I was working on didn't end up getting published. It was so satisfying to work on it and have somebody give me some feedback and be like, you know, like right here when she's doing this thing, if instead she turned around and saw the guy out of the corner of her eye, that would be way more compelling. And then I get excited. I'm like, oh, that is a great idea. I could do that and this and the other thing. And so it really kept me going and fueled me when I wasn't getting a lot of other external validation that trying to be a published author was a good idea.
That's so interesting, and kind of focusing more on maybe the process and the experience of it. And having had a group for that long, is there any advice you would give about how to sustain a writing group and, you know, pitfalls? Or I just think it's so unusual to have had the same group for so long. What have you kind of learned to keep it going that could help other writers?
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely lots of lessons learned over the years, and we've had other members sort of come and go. So, there's a core four of us who have been at it for the full length of time. There is like kindness above all. And again, that applies to all areas of life. Right. You know, it's to give the thoughtful critique, but emphasis on the thought. So it's not, I didn't like it, or this is boring, or, you know, you always do this or whatever. It's, you can say those things, you can give those pieces of information that you have a tendency to X, Y, or Z, but it's just how you frame it, and that you're coming at it from as the person giving the critique, you're coming at it from a place of, wouldn't it be exciting if we could improve this, you know? And then as the person getting the critique, I have had, I mean, it's less so now because I've got a tougher skin, but, you know, I have been hurt. I've had my feelings hurt. I've been sad and like, or angry as well. Like, oh, they didn't get it. And he was telling me this thing and he's just wrong. And I've definitely had those reactions as well. But I haven't, you know, I think I've been able to then walk away and take a beat or two and then think about it. And what it always comes back to is, if you can talk, if people can give you ideas, even if they're bad ideas, if that then generates the creativity and makes you think, oh, you come at it from a different angle that you couldn't see because you're so stuck in your own viewpoint. So it's so valuable. And so I think that is a really sustaining thing with critique. Obviously, you don't want to be in some sort of abusive critique group where you're right, feeling lousy. But if you can just distance yourself that tiny little bit from your writing, which you're pouring yourself into and you're so vulnerable, but if you can just take that step back and say, oh, but this is going to make it better. Or even though I reject what he's saying, it has sparked another idea that's going to be amazing. And I wouldn't have had that spark unless I'd had that, unless somebody had had a conversation with me, like a deep conversation with me about what I'd written. So that's really helpful. And then just in terms of like logistics and practicalities, I would say you need people who are committed. And I think you also need people who are all writing. I think if you have people in your critique group who aren't actively writing or actively trying to improve their writing, then I think you kind of, it shifts the power dynamic a little bit. Like if they're too shy to share, or they, you know, they got burned out a couple of years ago, so they're not writing anything now. I think everybody needs to be vulnerable, and everybody needs to be willing to expose themselves a little and put themselves out there, because then that shifts everybody's approach to critique, because you're not going to be as much of a jerk. Not that people usually are, but you're not going to be as sort of mean and tough on someone if you know that next week they're going to have your writing. And if you're a real meanie to them, you might get it back, right? Like, so it softens everybody, I think, to have that vulnerability. So I think that's another important element.
Well, and logistics wise, what have you found to be a frequency that keeps people engaged, but also doesn't become so much that then people can't?
Yeah, we've done, we do it once a month. And sometimes we cancel if nobody has anything. But so once a month, sort of 2 to 3 weeks before we're due to meet, so there's four of us in the group now. So one or two people, not usually three, because then that's too much time. So usually one or two people will say, I've got something, I'll send it. And so they'll send everybody else their work for that month's critique. And the group will have 2 to 3 weeks to read it. And then we'll come to the meeting. And usually the meeting's an hour to 2 hours, depending. Usually on a Sunday morning is when we do it, because that works for us. And then we'll just, everybody, you know, if I've submitted something for something, then my critique partners will, you know, Wayne will start and he'll go through his critiques, and then Alette will jump in and she'll say, oh, I agree with you, Wayne. And they'll have a whole conversation about my writing where I'm serious notes. And then Chris will say something, and then it'll be Chris's turn, and he'll give any other feedback that hasn't already been had. And then if there's anything left that hasn't been covered, then Alette will have her turn, and then I'll be done and I'll take a moment to get my head in order, and then we'll turn to whoever the other person is who submitted the writing for that week, and then we'll do them.
That makes sense. Well, just a last couple questions. I would love to hear if there are any books that you've been enjoying as a reader lately.
Yeah, I have been I have gone down the Kate Atkinson rabbit hole, and I'm a huge, huge fan of hers. And she's got a new Jackson Brody mystery coming out in the fall. So that has kind of inspired me to do a reread and a re-listen, because I'm getting the audiobooks from the library, which is delightful. So her first Jackson Brody mystery is Case Histories. Are you familiar with Kate Atkinson? And
I am, but I haven't read those.
No, I love these. She's one of my favorite mystery writers, and those Jackson Brody ones are great because they do that thing of, they have the, there's always a sort of a hit, there's always history, not necessarily like the study of history and archives and historical records and stuff like that, but there's always something, the past is always really impinging on the present, and that has to be untangled in order to sort of sort out what the heck's going on today. And so I find that really compelling. So
I'll definitely link to those.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's four or five. So if you're just new to Kate Atkinson, you've got a wealth of books to read, which is great.
Awesome. And I was so curious as I was finishing up this one, finishing up Honor of the Dead, is there anything you're able to say about what we're going to see in book four?
Oh boy. No, I have not wrapped my head around book four, but what I would love to do is as I said, the first book, Foulest Things, doesn't feature, it's sort of a prequel. It happens about 10 years before the events of Speak for the Dead. And what I'd love to do now is bring some of the characters from the Foulest Things into the Kate Spencer world and have everything.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah. So that's my sort of vaguest kernel of an idea, but I need a practical, like I said, when I start writing, I have like one image or one thought that's driving me, and I don't yet have it for that one. So I'm still cooking around in my head, but and maybe it's going to be partly in the Eastern Townships and partly back in Ottawa. I don't know. So I'll have to figure it out.
Well, I will very much look forward to that one. But Amy, it was just so much fun. It was so much fun to hear more about Honor the Dead and your process. And it's always such a delight to get to have you on. So thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoy your podcast. I get a lot of recommendations from you. So thanks.
Oh, wonderful.
For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can visit abookishhome.com. If you are enjoying the show, I hope you take a minute to subscribe and also rate and review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would encourage you to share it on social media to help other people find the show and this episode. Thanks for listening, everyone, and happy reading.